And welcome everyone to iCritic Live. This is the podcast where we talk about entertainment, pop culture, and life in between. I'm your host, Kevin T. Rodriguez, film critic of iCritic.net. Thank you so much for spending a few minutes of your time with me here today. Now, today we have a guest on. We are doing this live. This isn't podcast live. This is live on the YouTube channel. We've got a very special guest, arguably our most high-profile guest since the CEO of MoviePass stopped by. He has directed movies like Meet the Robinsons, Winnie the Pooh. He's working on the upcoming movie, the Garfield movie, and he is writing a book that I believe Disney fans will find very fascinating. Please welcome Stephen Anderson. Welcome, Stephen.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. Now, we talked a little briefly about how much of a movie nerd I am, and I guess I should start with a very simple question. Do you know a fan that has Meet the Robinsons in 3D?
Ooh, I love it. Yes, I don't think I do. I don't. I think my mother-in-law bought it back in the day when it came out. But beyond that,
I don't know anybody who has that. You know that we can actually watch this in 3D at my house. I actually, whenever I watch this movie, I put on the glasses and I let it all immerse me. Although, in all fairness, Avatar and How to Train Your Dragon are slightly better 3D experiences. But Meet the Robinsons was a really good one. I even remember what a big deal that was when we found out that there was going to be a 3D screening in Roseville of this. And I called my friend and said, hey, we got to take a little trip and go see Meet the Robinsons in 3D. And he's like, don't they make all the movies 3D? And I was like, no, like it's actually going to pop out of the screen. Screen 3D. We're not talking about the animation techniques, though. So, I so wish you could sign this right now.
but
since we're talking about it,
I'm happy to sign it.
All right. Well, we'll have to do that sometime. So I guess since we know you've made Meet the Robinsons, and I have always had this question. So before we get into the meat and potatoes of the conversation, I must ask, why did you change the name from A Day with Millward Robertson to Meet the Robinsons when the former title seems to make more sense in more ways than one?
Yeah. We started off calling it that, and we called it A Day with Wilbur Robinson for quite a few years. But there was feelings that from the kind of executive side of things that it might make the movie sound a little young. Like A Day with Wilbur Robinson, you know, it might sound a little bit like it's going to be butterflies and bunnies hopping around. And so they wanted to find something with a little more that might age up the movie a little bit. And I guess they're not wrong, but I think, number one, the source material that the movie was based on, Bill Joyce's book, was A Day with Wilbur Robinson. So I felt like, well, we should call it that. And also, I think to your point, it puts the appropriately broad umbrella over the story, because for me, when you just call it Meet the Robinsons, then I think the audience expectation is that it's going to be about this family, the Robinsons. And while it is partly about them, it's really more about Lewis and his incredible day with this kid named Wilbur Robinson, how he gives him hope for his future again after losing it. And that means both as an inventor and in terms of getting a family. So it's like kind of twofold. So I always felt like Meet the Robinsons might create expectations in the audience that might be a little too narrow. But we were sort of powerless to stop that, as is often the case. And so, there could have been worse titles.
These are probably the same executives who decided to change The Bear and the Bow into the very generic Brave, which I never understood, because The Bear and the Bow was a brilliant title for two reasons. One, it actually gives you an idea what the movie's about. Yeah. But secondly, when you do see the movie, it's like, oh, this is a subtle way of calling the movie Mother and Daughter.
Uh-huh, yeah, absolutely.
So it's like, and some executive had to go screw that up.
Yeah. Sometimes they have good ideas, sometimes they don't. But I mean, I guess we can say that about all of us, I suppose.
Some ideas work and some ideas don't. And thankfully, at the end of the day, what really matters is that Meet the Robinsons was a good movie at the end of the day. although the middle section actually, so I'm going to share a story. Don't take this too personally, but I remember like years ago when like I recommended the movie to people, like the pastor of my church, like rented the movie. He didn't get to see it in theater. And he admitted that he had turned it off after 35 or so minutes because he said, yeah, the family drove me nuts. It was random. I didn't get where it was going. And he's like, okay, so what happens? And so then I explained the ending, what is arguably the best twist villain ever in a Disney film. And I explained what happened at the end. He was like, what? Like all that. And so he had to go back and watch it again. Yeah. That sounds interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. There, I will admit, there's kind of a, there's lots of tone shifts in the movie. Definitely when you get to the future and you meet the Robinsons, the movie kind of kicks into, more, almost
Looney Tunes. Comedic gear. Yeah. Looney Tunes.
And yeah, pacing is something I have trouble watching the movie period just because I relive everything in my head. So I don't really watch the movie, but anytime I have caught bits and pieces of it, particularly in the that second act area, the one thing I wish if I could go back and do it again, I would want to add more room to breathe and just throughout the whole movie. I think we may have, for my money, I think we trimmed it a little too tight. And that might be have contributed to why, to why he had some issues with that sequence, because it is very fast paced.
Right. And you're not really getting to meet the Robinsons as well as you would have liked to. But again, that ending, because, Disney has done like the twist villain a lot, I'm going to say. But I think Meet the Robinsons and Frozen were kind of two of the only times where it really, from a story perspective, made sense. They were genuinely earned. I mean, because spoiler alert for anyone who has not seen this movie that's now, what, 19 years old? Or is it 18?
17, I guess. But who's counting?
Oh, jeez. the twist is that the villain is the kid's friend from when he was younger, grown up, disillusioned and everything. And so that made perfect sense from a story standpoint, and it didn't ruin anything. And of course the twist was Frozen is that if Hans is so aware of like the traditional way people view fairy tales, he is also playing with fairy tale conventions to get where he wants. You get to movies like Zootopia and Big Hero 6, which are good movies, by the way, folks, but the twist villain, it's like, okay, they come out of nowhere and then they're not acting like they were at the beginning of the movie. Kudos to you for creating a great twist villain, and also for having the courage to release Winnie the Pooh against Harry Potter in the Deathly Hallows Part 2.
That's another, speaking of executive decision making, that was another one that we had no say in, and it was originally going to come out in, I think, March or April, and then we were invited to go across the street and meet with the man who was in charge of release dates and that kind of thing. And he dumped that one on us, and we kind of said, really? And he said, oh, don't worry. It's a totally different audience. Harry Potter, Winnie the Pooh, there won't be any competition whatsoever. And as we walked back across the street to our studio, we're like, I think that they are full of you know what.
And
sure enough, they kind of were, because we got torpedoed. But what are you going to do?
Yeah, because I mean, I know in theory it's like, well, Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows Part 2 is a really dark movie. It's not a movie my parents would have taken me to see.
Yeah,
as a kid. Taken me to see Winnie the Pooh, because they had like a strict G rating rule, maybe some PGs if it was a really mild one.
Yeah.
But parents today take their kids to PG-13 and R-rated movies, and Harry Potter 100%. Started as a kid's movie. The kids want to finish it. It seemed really baffling, although I will say, as God is my witness, I did see Winnie the Pooh on opening day instead of Harry Potter. I was actually working at Disneyland, and I said, I'm going to the movies after work. And they're like, oh, I know what you're going to go see. And I'm like, yep, Winnie the Pooh. And they looked at me and they're like, not Harry Potter. It's like, are you kidding me? Do you know how crazy those theaters are going to be? I'm going to go to the movie that, in all fairness, I felt no one would be at. And sure enough, there was five people
Yeah.
It was, and it was really sad because it was like, oh, it's such a charming movie. And I really like the songs. I remember noting in my review, like, oh, I hope they work with these songwriters again because they did some really good work. And then like a Frozen or two later, that prediction was correct. But, you know, but I felt so bad for Disney Animation when Winnie the Pooh tanked because I heard, and maybe you can confirm this or not, that was kind of the catalyst to where it's like, well, maybe we don't want to get into hand-drawn movies anymore, which if it is, that's unfair because, you know, first of all, it's Winnie the Pooh's always been like a smaller theatrical event. But secondly, you threw it up against Harry Potter. What did you think was going to happen?
Exactly. Yeah, I know that while I don't necessarily agree with the assessment that Princess and the Frog was a failure. It was, I guess it did not do the box office that they were hoping it was going to do or what they predicted it was going to do. So that coupled with Winnie the Pooh not doing very well, definitely kind of made 2D be excused from the conversation.
Yeah. Which is kind of a shame because I think Princess and the Frog's success was also kind of hindered. Granted, I will give them credit. This time, no one could have seen it coming because the first weekend it did pretty well. It had a pretty good hold the second weekend, but then the third weekend, Avatar opened, and who thought that was going to be a big hit? I mean, I'll give them credit. It's not like someone at the time was going to look. It's like, Avatar, is that competition? Probably not. I've never heard of it. So,
well, the other frustrating thing with Pooh, just as a quick little side note to that, was the whole reason the movie was made was because this was around 2008. We were told that Bob Iger wanted to reinvigorate Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh was a big franchise for the company, consumer product wise, but they had felt like it had gotten really, really young down like into, you know, nursery level, like on diapers and, you know, crib bedding and that kind of stuff. So they said, hey, let's get Winnie the Pooh a little more for everybody. Let's do this huge company-wide initiative. Every division in the company, theatrical, parks, publishing, you name it, we'll do something with Winnie the Pooh and we'll kick it off with feature animations movie. And we were like, great, that sounds cool. And we had several meetings with all different division heads of the different divisions. They all gathered in the studio in Burbank and we pitched to them what we were doing with the movie, had some brainstorms about how all the other divisions could do stuff. And then cut to a few years later when the movie was coming out, they buried it, you know, against Harry Potter. And then basically none of the other divisions did anything else for Winnie the Pooh. Nothing that really they had talked about ever came to fruition. And so the whole Pooh thing was like torpedoed as well. And I never quite understood that because I thought, what happened to this big Bob Iger's big company-wide initiative? It just fizzled.
I wonder.
Also very frustrating. I just never got, I never understood it.
But I wonder if the reason, because I think it was either that year or the year before they bought Marvel. Do you think maybe priorities, if that did happen around the same time, do you think priorities might have shifted?
It could have been, for sure.
Yeah, kind of like how it took more than a decade to get a Tron 3 because they made Tron to compete with Star Wars, and once you buy Star Wars, well, why do you need Tron per se?
Yeah.
So yeah, I kind of wonder if, or if they hadn't bought it, maybe they were in the process of it because I don't remember merchandise or anything. And the weird thing is, Pooh, for as long as I could remember, ironically, before the movie came out, was like a $2 to $3 billion sales thing every year.
Yeah, it was huge. They kept saying it was second only to Mickey Mouse in terms of consumer product revenue. So they thought, what a great idea. Let's re-energize it across the company.
Yeah, it would make sense. And I mean, they practically own it. I know they don't own it, but they have pretty strong ties with it. So it would have made sense. And I also agree that, maybe it was time to, you know, not make Pooh a horror film. It's a terrible idea, and no one should ever try that, by the way. It'll end bad for you. You might win a Razzie Award. But, you know, I saw the Pooh Hemphillip movie. I saw Piglet's Big Movie. And back when I was a teenager and writing reviews for the high school newspaper. And I remember having to explain to my friends all the time, you gave it 3 stars? It's like, well, yeah, as a kid's film, it's fine. It's like, so do you recommend we see it? No, not really. It's kind of boring for people our age. But the new Winnie the Pooh, like, hey, it was it's fun and it's smartly written. It's not too long. And I, for the first time ever, I realize Eeyore is clinically depressed and I'm worried about him now. I think that's the first time I realized that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely had some fun with him.
Oh, yeah. So yeah. And you haven't, now you haven't made a film. Well, I mean, you haven't directed, I should say, a film since Winnie the Pooh. I know that you pitched some movie called The Earth and the Sky, but then you heard about How to Train Your Dragon and that got shelved. Was that your decision or was that executive saying it's too similar to this other movie that's being made?
Well, that was actually before Winnie the Pooh. I was sort of developing that and John Lasseter said, if you want to, let's, you know, invited me to come on to Winnie the Pooh. And of course I wanted to do that. So I put my development stuff on the side. And then while we were making Pooh, How to Train Your Dragon came out. So it was really kind of no point in going back to it. But it never really got that far along. It was still very, broad stroke.
And you know, these things happen. I mean, they were going to make Newt, and then when they saw what Rio was like, they were like, I think it's too similar. And maybe you could shed some light on this. I don't know, but I know for a long time, like DreamWorks and Pixar, which by extension meant Disney and DreamWorks, really almost kind of like had like competing movies. You had Ants and A Bug's Life. Sorry, folks, Ants is better. Then you had Shark Tale and Finding Nemo. Finding Nemo was better in that case. But then at some point, it seemed like they kind of diverted, and it's like, okay, we're not going to compete. Do you know what was going on that caused so many similar movies to be made?
I mean, I don't know for a fact, but I can wager a guess that...
Oh, we love guesses.
That Katzenberg at the time was really, you know, being competitive with Disney and trying to, you know, since he had been at Disney and he, you know, left under not super great terms, I think it was his chance to, hey, I'm going to beat them at their own game. And it does seem like once they got into CG, once Shrek hit, well, I guess Shark Tale was after that. Maybe not for every example, but it feels like gradually once they got into CG, that competition sort of started eroding and they didn't do that as much anymore. Never really thought about that. I wonder when that kind of stopped. Because Shrek was not I'm going to compete with you. It was, I'm going to skewer you. we're going to actually make a movie that satirizes Disney stuff. So that almost felt like that was, instead of trying to beat them at their own game, they created a new game, which was let's make fun of you. And definitely beat them then, for sure.
Yeah, well, I'm working on a video series where I look at the history of the best animated feature Oscar and why certain movies got nominated and won. And it was so interesting to go back to the year 2001 and have to put myself like, okay, why did Shrek beat Monsters, Inc.? And you really had to almost put yourself back in that time and realize how fresh it all seemed. Because at first, DreamWorks was almost copying Disney in other ways. Like, oh, Prince of Egypt, it's a big musical. Road to El Dorado, hey, let's get Elton John and Hans Zimmer back. It worked for The Lion King. So, and you know, those are fun. And you know, Prince of Egypt is excellent. El Dorado is pretty good. Not great, but pretty good. And then when Shrek came out, it just seemed like, it was like total game changer. And then they changed themselves up again with Kung Fu Panda. And Disney was kind of going through a transformative year. Because I remember seeing, I remember when they made Chicken Little. Chicken Little is what it was called. And it just felt so not Disney. Like, I was like so disappointed. And, then I saw Meet the Robinsons, and it's like my faith has been restored a little bit.
And you're right, because so that's the interesting irony is that DreamWorks created this new thing of doing CG that's very contemporary, that's like a lot of anachronistic jokes, even though it was set in a period time. They're doing very contemporary jokes, contemporary music, contemporary slang, like characters that basically live today there, even though they're from a different era. That whole kind of feeling, that was a huge success. And then the leadership at Disney after that kept trying to do that. The original version of Glenn Keane's Rapunzel was called Rapunzel Unbraided. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of that was, let's do like a Shrek-like thing. We'll do a fairy tale, but we'll have contemporary characters being zapped into a fairy tale world, and we'll do all kinds of contemporary references and music and have actors that, you know, have a very contemporary voice. Chicken Little is the same thing. Let's do a lot of needle drop music, existing songs that already, you know, people know. Let's do kind of snarky humor, all that stuff. That's not how Chicken Little began. That's not how the team really wanted it to go. It's not how the director, Mark Tindall, that's not his sensibilities. But it was this where the executives drove it, because they were trying to now compete with Shrek, trying to now compete with DreamWorks and do that same kind of thing. So in a weird way, then DreamWorks almost created a new genre within animation of that kind of contemporary comedy.
Yeah. Although I'm really glad that it Tangled did not get made that way. You know, I love Glenn Keane. He's one of my favorite animators at Disney, but even when I heard the project, I was like, this doesn't seem like something Glenn Keane would want to make.
And it wasn't. That's the funny thing, is it's the very, very, very first version was he wanted to do a straight traditional Disney fairy tale musical. And the executives at the time said, nah, we don't want to do that. Because that's not really, people don't want to see that anymore. Let's make it more like Shrek. So Glenn, being the team player, was trying to make that work, but I don't think his heart was in it. Again, he was doing everything he could to make it work. So I'm not saying he was phoning it in or anything, but it certainly was not what his heart told him to make. So eventually he was able to get back to that once things changed. But
right.
I'm with you. I don't think that would have worked out so well.
I don't think Dindal wanted to make Chicken Little that way. You watch Cats Don't Dance and The Emperor's New Groove, and he's like into the Gene Kelly Looney Tunes era of filmmaking, even though characters just move. you almost feel like when I'm watching Emperor's New Groove, and this is going to get a lot of people watching to raise their eyebrow. And I was 11 when I thought this. So, you can either thank my parents or you can hate my parents, but I watch it and I'm like, it kind of feels like Bringing Up Baby. Just the way that it's like, they just have to do this one simple thing and then hijinks.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, Mark has a huge affinity for, you know, classic cartoons, classic movies, those kind of the whole kind of screwball comedy feel. You can feel that in the movies that are much more Mark. But he's also has a lot of heart in what he does, and I think that's one of the things Chicken Little could have used a little bit more of, with some good, you know, grounded emotion.
But yeah, and usually you can kind of tell what people think about the movie they just made when they leave the studio right after they release this movie that's a big hit financially speaking. All right. So anyway, I want to talk a little bit about your most recent project. Then we'll talk about the book. By the way, I see that your first jobs as an animator were for like Rover Dangerfield, Baby's Kids, and one of my favorite shorts of all time, the Itsy Bitsy Spider.
Oh.
Oh my gosh, I love that shirt.
I never say that.
really? No one's ever brought up the Itsy Bitsy Spider? It has Jim Carrey. Oh, I'm sorry, James Carrey.
Yeah.
In it, and Thora Birch, and it was like, I actually kind of looked, it's like, how the heck did that not get a Best Animated Short Oscar? Oh, wait, I know why. It was attached to Baby's Kids, and nobody liked Baby's Kids, unfortunately.
Yeah.
That was like, yeah, Baby's Kids was another tragedy, because it almost shows the inequality of Hollywood, where it's like, oh, they finally made an animated movie for primarily African-American audiences, and it was so bad that it took them like 20 something years before they tried again, which is terribly unfair in my opinion. Yeah. But I hear you worked on Monsters at Work.
I did, yes. I was one of the supervising directors of season one. I did not work on the current season that just premiered last week, but I worked on season one, yeah.
Yeah, I hope it gets a season three, although I am very, very pessimistic about that, because when you watch Monsters, Inc., it has the Pixar quality that you come to expect from them. And it also comes in a way where you look at it, it's like there is no possible way they're making money on this.
Yeah.
Unless people all of a sudden buy a bunch of Monsters, Inc. crap, there is absolutely no way this show is, profitable. But it was also nice to kind of see how Pixar would do TV, because I think this was the first time they really were truly involved in one of their series. So I know that Buzz Lightyear Star Command didn't have much to do with them, and apparently it's so disliked it's decanonized. It's not even on Disney Plus. It's so looked down upon, you can stream the whole thing on YouTube and Disney's not copyright claiming it.
Got a huge fan base, that's for sure. I know a lot of people grew up on that, love that
channel. My nephew loves Buzz Lightyear. In fact, when my brother and his wife are getting tired of watching Toy Story 1 through 4 over and over again, I said, hey, go to YouTube and watch Buzz Lightyear Star Command. At least you'll have something new to watch. But what was the experience of Monsters at Work? By the way, folks, if you haven't seen the show, it's a great premise. It is a sequel to Monsters, Inc., and it follows the idea that this monster goes to scare school. He gets his degree. He's going to be the next big scare. And then when he shows up, the company has completely changed direction and his degree is useless. I'm sure no one's ever had that happen before. So what was it like working on this series?
Well, I mean, for me, it was a blast. I loved working on this show. Number one, just sort of personally and emotionally, I'd been stuck in development at Disney Feature Animation since Winnie the Pooh came out. And been pitching lots of ideas. And I had one idea that was just going nowhere, and I couldn't take it anymore. So I stepped away from that. I just couldn't do it. I was friends with the two executive producers on Monsters at Work. And they said, hey, we have an opening for supervising director. If you want to do that. Perfect opportunity for me, because it was like day one, we were making something. And I had just spent, 7-8 years developing things, which is somewhat active, but it's actually a lot of just sitting around waiting. And I really needed to I just needed to do something. So Monsters was like, hit the ground running. And I love that. I really love the pace of TV. I know a lot of people are like, when I moved over, they said, boy, you must hate going from features to TV because it's so much quicker. And I'm like, no, I love that. I love doing it. The whole team was great. The world was so much fun to work within. You can't not have fun playing with Mike and Sully and crazy monsters all day. It's like, it was a blast.
Yeah. Although Mike and Sully's not in the show that much, which kind of makes me wonder, were they there for like one day or something? Because they have like brief cameos in every other episode, I've noticed.
But still, great, fun characters, super fun characters, and just that whole world and all the other cast of characters. It was great. I loved working on season one of Monsters at Work.
And you actually expanded the world of Monsters, Inc. You and your team, with all due respect to Pixar, way better than they did with Monsters University. Monsters University, I felt, kind of had like the Flintstones problem joke, where it's like, okay, this movie has one joke in that there's a monster version for every college class out there, and you're just telling that joke over and over again. Whereas the premise of Monsters at Work actually does have almost a tragic undertone to it. It's like, yeah, your degree is worthless and you're at your dream job, but it didn't work out the way you wanted to. And can you find happiness in the new role that you never thought you'd find yourself?
Yeah.
And I think it showed that Pixar, they would make great TV. I don't think we're going to get a lot more Pixar TV shows, because first of all, the streaming wars proved to be very unprofitable. And I was saying that for years, like there's no way they're making money off all this stuff.
Yeah.
But you don't want Monsters at Work to come back and they're like, okay, we're going to slash the budget and they're not going to have fur on them. It's like, no. It's like, this is the world's so well-defined that if you start changing the animation style, it's not going to be great. But yes, I did like the first season. I've enjoyed the second season too, even though you're not part of it.
I was there in spirit.
You were there in spirit. But no, what you are actually working on, it appears, is something that a lot of Disney animators work on in between projects. You are working on a book called Disney in Between the Lost Years. And by the way, $10,020.
Oh, wow. I haven't seen it lately. Wow. Yep.
835% of your goal reached. Congratulations, sir.
Thanks.
Yep.
Thank you, everybody.
Remember, folks, all of us funded it. So if this book sucks, it's our fault because we paid for it before we even knew what we were buying. And I say that as a joke because I asked, like, hey, should I read the book? And you're like, I don't have a whole lot of the book to share with you because I'm still writing it. And it's like, okay, I've worked with less before. So I'm going to take a guess that based on this title, this is going to be about Disney animator and corporate culture between 1966 and 1986.
That is correct.
That is correct.
I tried to skew it a little more to the creative side of things just because I'm not as smart when it comes to like business and corporate stuff. There's a little bit of that here and there, but for me, I was just mainly interested in how the creative process at Disney was affected by Walt's death. And then how did it change? How did it evolve? How did it go from the Walt days to something totally new and get reinvented by the mid 80s? So a little more towards the creative side of things.
Well, that's good. And I'm also intrigued by the years because, you know, those are the Ron Miller years. And so I did a CEO ranking for the Disney CEOs, and I actually listed Ron Miller as the worst of the CEOs because and you know, worst is like subjective. This doesn't mean he's an evil guy. It didn't mean he wasn't trying. That's not, you know, good. Well intentioned sometimes blow up in your face. But, you know, I acknowledge that he was trying to steer the ship. Like, I think he's the one who came up with the Touchstone Pictures label. He was the first one to approach George Lucas, who was developing Star Wars as like a mall ride. And he's like, that's too good for malls. Why don't we bring it to Disneyland? And apparently he was the one to option who censored Roger Rabbit, even if he didn't actually get it into production. He optioned the book. So forward thinking. But he was also a guy who kind of was stuck between two worlds. He was a competent businessman, and yet because it was his father-in-law's company, he didn't want to rock the boat too much. He kept going like, well, what would my father-in-law do? And ultimately, it was the subject of like a corporate takeover, almost a corporate takeover, kind of similar to what's happening now. And Roy Disney voted him out, got him out of there, which put a strain between him and his cousin Diane for a while. So this is a time period that's very, very sensitive to a lot of people who have history with the company. So we'll read books like Keys to the Magic Kingdom, Disney War, basically everything that happened during the Eisner and Katzenberg era. But we don't get a lot of books like about this era. So what inspired you to look at this era and say, I want to write a book about the dark ages of Disney, if you will?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, from a very selfish standpoint, that's the Disney of my childhood. So while I know it's not the sexiest time in the company's history, those are the movies that I grew up with. When I see clips of movies like Apple Dumpling Gang and Escape from Witch Mountain and Pete's Dragon and Condor Man, I get excited because I remember how excited I was for those when they came out when I was a kid. And I love those movies. So I just wanted to relive all those films and find out more about what was going on in the studio and meet some of the people that worked on those films and find out the stories. I just thought, like, again, from a selfish standpoint, I wanted to know. It's like, I wanted to read this book. But also to your point, it is a very oft overlooked era of the Disney studios. If you look at a lot of history books of Disney, they tend to go from Walt's passing. They might mention a few films in there, like maybe Bedknobs and Broomsticks, maybe Black Cauldron, maybe Fox and the Hound, Rescuers, a couple of live actions, maybe Apple Dumpling Gang and, you know, Pete's Dragon or something. And then it'll go into the 80s, the mid-80s, and it'll jump to like Little Mermaid and the Touchstone era of Down and Out Beverly Hills and Ruthless People and those, you know, mid to late 80s films. When the company went back, got back on its feet and was thriving again. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, yes, the time before this era and the time after this era are very exciting times in the studio's history, and lots to be learned from those. But I also think there is just as much to learn from the transition periods, from the times that aren't as rosy, from the times of struggle, the times where you might be a little lost in the woods and you're trying to find your way again. There's just as much interesting stories and just as much to learn from the in-between times as there are from the extremes, the times on the other sides of those in-between eras. So I felt it was necessary and worthwhile to tell that story.
Yeah, because, I mean, even though that's not the quote-unquote premium year of Disney, they tried some interesting things during that time, like The Watcher in the Woods, The Black Hole. Actually, you know, I have to give credit to Seth MacFarlane. He made Watcher in the Woods like a top search on Google because they mentioned it in TED as being a scary movie, and they're making them like, it's a Disney film. It can't be that scary. And, well, it got me to finally watch it for the first time, and it's like, oh, shoot, Bette Davis is in this? I should have watched this a lot sooner. So what are some of the stories that we can we expect to see? Are we going to hear about some of the more contentious things? Like, is Don Bluth going to be brought up in this? Is the Robin Hood recycling animation controversy? Or is it going to be like, you're just going to focus on the people who were just doing the best that they could? I also got to ask, is the Black Cauldron going to come up in this? That's a story that seems like seems like that could be its own book itself.
Yeah, you can't tell the story without the Black Cauldron.
Yes,
that's a hugely important puzzle piece. Well, it's yes to everything that you just said. Beginning with firsthand account of the euphoria of Disney in the 50s and early 60s from a man named Bernie Mattinson, who passed away last year. But prior to his passing, he was the longest running Disney employee in history. If he had made it to, I think it was June or July of 2023, he would have hit 70 years with the company. And so he became a friend of mine that I met during, because he worked at animation. Bernie did everything at Disney, from being an in-betweener, being an animator, being a story artist. He directed Mickey's Christmas Carol and Great Mouse Detective, and produced both of those as well. And then continued as a story artist. He was kind of a story consultant for us on Winnie the Pooh. And so, you know, Bernie's like the spine of the book. Bernie began his time at Disney in 1953. So pretty much like, aside from the 40s and the wartime era, pretty much saw the everything of the Walt Disney Company, the modern contemporary Walt Disney Company, or modern to the, at the time. So we begin with a firsthand account from Bernie of what the studio was like in the 50s and 60s. He described it as being like Camelot. It was like Disneyland was being built. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was being shot. Lady and the Tramp was being made. Like it was just that all the Walt Disney Television stuff was really kicking into gear. The live action animated episodes were being made for TV, Wonderful World of Disney. So we start there, and then we move through Walt's death and into how that impacted everyone, how that impacted both the generation that was already there, who were Walt's colleagues, and how they dealt with losing their compass, their North Star. But then also how it affected the generation that hadn't gotten to Disney yet, that grew up as fans of Walt Disney, as fans of the films, and then came into the studio saying, hey, I'm here in Walt's playground, basically. But then come to find that there's a lot of stagnation. There's a lot of lack of forward momentum because of that fear of how to move forward without Walt Disney. So you get a lot of that generational conflict of older generations that want to keep things the way it is, the way they are, and preserve how it used to be. And younger generations who want to break all those molds and say, no, no, let's do something new. Let's do something different. Let's change things. And that kind of, classic struggle, generational struggle that you see, it was totally on display during this time period.
Yeah. Yeah. I know one of the more controversial decisions was like, I know the animators wanted to like start making more animated movies, and Ron Miller was kind of like, well, we've always done like one every 4 years. And it's like, okay, like on one hand, I don't want to oversaturate the market, but one every 4 years, maybe that was sustainable for Walt because he had other things he wanted to work on personally. He couldn't stretch himself too thin. But if you have different teams, well, why not make a movie once every two years and stuff like that? I keep telling people, and my wife is blowing up my cell phone right now. Like, walk Lilo. By the way, we have a dog named Lilo and a cat named Stitch. we're Disney nerds. We had a Disney wedding and everything. So I've had this conversation with some people about animation general where they're like, they're releasing too many animated films every year. No wonder one or two of them always bomb. It's like, the issue isn't that they're releasing too many animated films. That's like saying you're releasing too many live action films. You're releasing too many movies that are targeting the same audience.
Right.
I remember getting back on DreamWorks temporarily when they were like, we're going to do three movies a year. And they tried that for a couple of years, and it just ended up not being sustainable. I'm like, well, I think it's because you like approached it the wrong way. I think that three film thing would have worked out. You know, you make one movie that's a sequel, that's your guaranteed hit. You make a second one that stands on its own, but could be the start of a new franchise. And then the third one, you make a very low budget experimental award baity film. Mm-hmm. And that's how you do it. But you don't put three sequels out there, and if people don't want to watch two of them, then you're in trouble.
Right.
But I think that three picture thing was doable. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say the other thing in terms of, the number of films they could do back then. There was just a matter of crew size. Like the animation studio was really small and was getting smaller because a lot of the many of the nine old men were like Mark Davis had already gone to Imagineering. Some of them were retiring. Some of the generation right underneath the nine old men were either passing away, retiring as well. So the ranks were being depleted, which is also part of this era of let's open the doors for the first time in a long time and bring in young talent. Because if we don't do that, Disney Animation is going to die with these artists. We have to pass on the torch. They really hadn't done that since, I think, like the mid to late 50s. They brought in a lot of young people to work on Sleeping Beauty. That's when Don Bluth came in. I believe that's when Floyd Norman came in. Getting into the animation ranks. But so it had been probably a good 20 years since they'd done that. So in 1971, they said, let's do that. Let's start a training program and let's bring in more people. So then the ranks grew, and then it became a little more feasible to make more films, more animated films. But there was also that reality of, well, it was such a small group of people making those animated films. Another also why the films got so much more simple. A lot of the lush effects and tones and shadows and all that kind of stuff from the Pinocchio days kind of went by the wayside because they had to make them cheaper and quicker. So
it always bothered me as a kid, and maybe this is why I never connected with Robin Hood very much. Mm-hmm. Was that there's animation sequences that are literally traced mm-hmm. from other movies. Now, of course, as an adult and I look back, it's like, okay, that was like an economic reality. And also, in all fairness, they didn't have VHS back then. They could not have predicted someone actually taking out a tape and going like, huh, that looks similar.
Nope. No way.
they couldn't have predicted that. But no. Since I came into Disney during the VHS days, and in fact, the very first movie I ever remember watching was Dumbo, and that's what got me started on my film loving career. But I always mm-hmm. I just recognize, like, they're copying The Jungle Book. Mm-hmm. Like, they're literally copying The Jungle Book. And then later on, because I think I didn't see Snow White until it was 96 or 97 when they did a theatrical re-release. And then I could notice, like, it kind of goes to show how many times I watched Robin Hood, even though I didn't particularly care for it. But then I noticed the Snow White things, and it was, and then it always bothered me that, the first half and the second half of the film don't have much to do with each other when you get to get down to it. And there's nothing that really ties it. Like, the resolution almost happens off screen. This is a film critic in me coming out. It's still a fine movie for kids. I just, I guess from that era, I like The Fox and the Hound better, which, simple though it may be, has a consistent story, has a tangible conflict, has a very sad scene where she lets go of Todd. I keep wondering, though, was Chief supposed to die in that movie? Because it never made sense why Copper was so upset when Chief just got away with a broken leg.
Yeah, I talk about that in the book. A couple people told me some stories about that. In the source book, Fox and the Hound, apparently Chief does die. And when some of the younger folks who were working on the film saw that the older guys that were directing the film pulled back on that idea and only, had Chief, like you said, have a broken leg at the end. Again, the younger people are like, what's wrong with you? Like, you got to push. You got to go to those darker places, have higher stakes in these films. That's what's going to make them appeal to a broader audience, not just these kids' films, because the more you pull those things out, the younger those films become. And they said, no, because that's not our audience, and we don't want to get letters from parents, and we don't want to scare kids, and that kind of thing. So again, back to that generational conflict of the old guard who sort of wants to play it safe and wants to keep things all nice and happy. Mm-hmm. And then the younger generation that says, no, push, break, change. And that's a prime example of that is that movie.
Well, thank goodness they got over that in time for The Lion King and Pocahontas.
Yeah, right.
Because, I know that Pocahontas has become like a divisive film for reasons that I don't completely agree with, but I remember it stuck out at me, like, at the end when it's like, wait, she's not going to go with him? Mm-hmm. Like, she's going to stay behind because her people, like, that, you know. And then when I saw The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which that's actually my personal favorite Disney film, even though I acknowledge Beauty and the Beast is technically the best one they've ever made, but, like, that Hellfire sequence, like, how that movie was just hard on the audience several times. It was like, that was the first time I felt like I was watching an adult animated movie.
Right. Look. Yeah, and I think that's why that's really how Pixar differentiated themselves too, when they, particularly with Toy Story. You have a protagonist in Woody who does unlikable things. Mm-hmm. He pushes Buzz out the window. And this is the guy we're rooting for. But that's okay because it's real. It's human, even though he's a toy. It's being truthful to that character and truthful to what it feels like to have that kind of jealousy of somebody. And we sometimes get consumed by those emotions and we do things that aren't necessarily likable, if you will. Would Disney have ever done that on their own? Did it take the Pixar folks to be on their own as independents elsewhere, literally elsewhere, to be able to make those decisions and to be able to make those choices in their films? I think that's also what helped make, you know, broaden the appeal of animated films, is when the characters could start becoming even that much more relatable, where they might make choices that they can still come back from them. They can still be redeemed, but then you might not like those choices that they make initially. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's hugely important for storytelling.
Yeah. Well, Pixar definitely nailed that on Finding Nemo, where, mm-hmm. you know, you're supposed to usually frown upon the kid disobeying his dad, but you totally understood why in that movie. Now, the funny thing is, the consequence was still like, oh, dad had a point. You shouldn't go up near the butt, if you will. But you don't blame him for doing that because his dad is just so suffocating.
Yep.
Oh, and I almost forgot. Let's go back to Meet the Robinsons for one second. Mm-hmm. Just thought of one more question I wanted to ask you on that, and then I think we'll be done with that for a while. You had Walt Disney's quote at the end, "We keep moving forward." Maybe you can settle a bet. Some of my friends felt that was put in there as the Disney studio justifying moving on from 2D animation. Is that true, or was it just, it just made sense to, like, what inspired putting that quote in the movie?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is, the theme for the movie was keep moving forward, before I stumbled upon that quote. So I'd say like 2/3 of the production, we came up with keep moving forward in the natural evolution of the story development process. Mm-hmm. And, that's what the movie was about. And then if I had read that Walt Disney quote prior to that, I had forgotten it. So then I was reading something in a magazine or something like that, and it had that keep moving forward quote from Walt Disney, and my brain just exploded because, you know, just those three words, keep moving forward, I'd been living with those words for all this time. And now to hear Walt Disney actually say it was like, this is crazy. And I showed it to a bunch of people, and one of them said, we should put that at the end of the movie. You know, the fact that Walt Disney actually said those three words, and there's so much of, you know, we did talk a lot about the Walt Disney's spirit of positive, forward thinking futurist that he was, in our film. It was not supposed to be direct reference to it, but, you know, our film was about we were not making a dystopian future film. We were not doing Blade Runner, or we weren't doing, you know, Escape from New York or any of that stuff.
Well, you did for 5 minutes.
True. But we wanted to do that positive vision of the future. And as a kid, I always loved the feeling of Tomorrowland and of Epcot. I love that, that futurism, the Disney futurism, that positive energy. So it like, it just brought all these elements together and we're like, yes, let's put it on the end. So it, it really, there was no other ulterior motive other than, hey, that's cool. That's okay. What a punctuation mark to put on the movie, you know?
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good to know because I don't know if you heard about it at the time, like at least a lot of my friends that, you know, we were, I don't hate 3D animation. I actually personally think Walt Disney would have loved 3D animation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we like the hand-drawn stuff and we hated to see that it was going away because corporate thought, oh, 3D movies are making a lot of money. It's like, well, who's going to pay to see Home on the Range? I mean, or Brother Bear. I mean, they're, Brother Bear's fine, I guess. Home on the Range is not very good. Like, so when my friend, you know, my friend saw that, they was kind of like, oh, they're giving us the middle finger now. But it's good to know there was no ill intention.
No way. No.
Involved.
It was not a corporate decision or a company decision. It was a filmmaker decision. So,
and that's great. That's great to hear. Like, and again, like I, it helped that soften the blow that Meet the Robinsons was a lot better than Chicken Little was. So anyway, folks, his book, Disney in Between the Lost Years, 1966, 1986. So, I guess you would have to cover the Black Cauldron. That was 1985. Mm-hmm. Disney's first PG rated film. I'm only going to bring that up because, someone in the chat has brought up the PG rating. I thought that might be fun to tackle on for a second. But so this thing has 36 days left. Is that when the books are going to ship or does the book still need to be written to a certain extent after 36 days?
No, the book is all written and put together. The books will ship in August if you pre-order on this Indiegogo page. Okay. It's also on Barnes & Noble right now and Amazon for pre-order as well.
Well, I'm going to pre-order here, so I'm going to pre-order here so I can get it signed and numbered.
Yeah.
Fancy. So that's where I will pre-order there.
And then it'll actually be hopefully on shelves in September. It'll be out and about in the world in September officially.
Awesome. So excellent. Well, anyway, folks, here it is. It's on Indiegogo. Search for Disney in Between the Lost Years, 1966 to 1986. He is, let's see here. Did any more people pre-order it since we started this thing? No, but hey, maybe we can get it to 1000% funded. I think that would be pretty awesome myself. All right. So since one of, our viewers has put in some things. And by the way, folks, anyone who's watching, you can ask questions as long as they're reasonable and like you're not asking like who's voting for who or like, you know, what turns a Disney animator on. Those are inappropriate questions. But if you have Disney related questions, now, Kalbaru, I hope that's how I pronounce it, said, a thing happened during that time is that between 1981 and 1985, Disney didn't release a single G-rated film. What Disney is now doing with the G rating isn't new. Now, I think what he meant was like basically the Disney films have not been G rated for a while. But, mm-hmm. You know, you look at the Black Cauldron that was given its first PG rating and it's like that feels like a PG rated film. And then you watch Tangled and Frozen and Big Hero 6. It's like, is this PG rated? I know you have no control over the ratings. That's the MPA. But yeah. I don't know. Do you have an opinion on how, you know, Disney, the maker of G-rated hits, now all there is PG films, and I don't know. Do you think they're PG-rated films?
It is strange. I'm not trying to think of what's my point of view. I guess my point of view on it is just kind of a bit of a is also kind of rubbing my chin and scratching my head, going, yeah, that's weird. PG is now the new G.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are, well, and by the way, well, I guess I don't, my son's not young enough to be going, well, not little anymore. He's 24. So I don't take him to movies anymore. So I'm not really aware of what's rated. But I guess because of streaming now, does anybody really pay attention to what movies are rated? It's more like if I'm watching it on Disney Plus, I guess it's okay for my family. If I'm watching it on Netflix, it could be okay for my family. It might be more adult. I guess I got to look and see what it, you know, does it say violence and nudity and all that stuff?
Yeah.
I don't know. Ratings have seemed to kind of become this weird abstract thing that nobody seems to talk about anymore. I guess they're there, but I don't know.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah. I've written a lot of, well, I mean, I used to, you know, when my reviews would pop up in the church newsletter, obviously the ratings had to be tackled. So they've never been far from my mind. And Disney actually is very good about it. They actually use the MPAA symbols on Disney Plus. But yeah, I just look at it. It's like, how on earth is, like, you know, the Lion King G if the Muppets is PG? PG, yeah. And the only objectionable thing to that was fart shoes, which is nothing. Right. And of course, I'm still waiting to kind of see how Disney pans out now that they've merged Hulu with Disney Plus, because that kind of seems like a sacred thing, that line that should never have been crossed. I know why they crossed it. Disney as a brand, it does kind of have a limited appeal, as you're going to get the Disney fans, the families, but getting the adult audience might be a little tough in some circumstances. And by the way, folks, I know there's adults who love animated Disney films, me included. So it's like, oh, let's put like Family Guy on Disney Plus. Let's put anime. One of my YouTube shorts that have gotten thousands of views is when I discovered Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac Parts 1 and 2. And it's like, Disney Plus has NC-17 rated movies on them.
Plus?
It's on Disney Plus. These movies have been rated NC-17.
What? Are you serious?
I am serious. I am that serious. If you have the app, look it up. They're there.
Holy smokes.
and I mean, and it's not even like it's covering up what it's about. It's like, I could just imagine, it's like, Mom, what's Nymphomaniac?
Wow.
It's like, what? It's like, why did you hear that word? It's on Disney Plus.
Disney taught me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, it's actually, as a Disney animator who has primarily made family movies, what do you think about like Total Recall and all these really adult properties being on a platform with Disney on it?
I think it's weird. I think it's very indicative of how, this is just my own personal opinion, of how the best way to say it, Disney, the concept of Disney is very ambiguous now. Disney is basically a thing that owns a bunch of other things that make a ton of different content. Because now you say Star Wars is Disney, but it's not really Disney. It's Star Wars. Marvel is Disney, but it's not. Pixar is Disney, but it's not. It's Pixar. So Disney is on all kinds of things that, in my opinion, aren't really Disney. This is, again, this is my own personal bias, but
right.
When I think back to the book that Disney In Between, back to that, you know, Walt's time, and then the before Eisner and Katzenberg came in the 80s, it was a small, essentially family-run business that made live-action movies, animated movies. They did theme parks. And they were all done for a family audience. They had a very clear identity. When you say Disney, you knew what that meant. Now, some felt that was a problem during that time period. That was, they were trying to get away from that, from kind of being stigmatized to being just for kids. But it was a very distinct, for the lack of a better word, label. When you said Disney, you knew what that was. I think now when you say Disney, I don't really know what Disney is anymore. I know it's a company. I know they make animation. I know they make live action. I know they have parks, but now there's Avatar in Disney parks. And now they're like, to me, it's just, again, my opinion, to me, it's just a jumble of things that don't really mean anything. It doesn't add up to anything now. It's just a corporate name. And I kind of think that's sad, but again, that might just be my own personal bias.
Well, I remember feeling like there was like maybe something a little lost when Pirates of the Caribbean was Disney's first PG-13 rated film. And it's like, you know, as Disney, there were just some lines he didn't cross.
Right.
By the way, someone pointed out that, not that one, but Raiders of the Lost Ark is on Disney Plus, and it's like, I don't know if that's a family film. Now, here we have an animation-related question. Inspired Figment, One Little Spark says, as a director, Steven, what were your personal thoughts on Disney's Once Upon a Studio versus Wish? And on an added note, my question, do you think either of them were snubbed for Oscars? That might be too personal of a question. You can just answer this question if you want. I don't want to get you in trouble.
Well, I was over the moon for Once Upon a Studio. I just thought it was incredible. It was just so lovely and charming, and like everything I wanted it to be, and everything it should have been, and everything that I wanted out of this 100 years celebration. I just thought it was fantastic. I haven't seen Wish. I just haven't seen it yet. So don't get mad at me. Nobody get mad at me. I haven't seen it, so I can't really compare. No offense to anybody who worked on Wish. I just haven't had a chance to see it yet. So
it was very disappointing. Don't get mad at me like this. But as someone who reviews movies for a living, I don't think you're missing much.
I will see it. I will definitely see it. It's just one of those things that slipped through the cracks for now.
Yeah. Wish was definitely like, I think Wish could have been better, but I think it fell into a trap that a lot of movies in general have fallen into, where it's like they're making so many references to other Disney movies that at some point it's kind of like, are they even telling a story anymore? Or is the whole point of this just to remind me of the stuff I used to like? Yeah. That was kind of like my feeling with like Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers. It's like, well, look, I enjoy it. Undeniably, I do. But I started getting bothered by, like, I'm enjoying the references. Like, oh, there's a South Park character. Oh, there's an Indiana Jones reference. And then it's like, there's Ugly Sonic. And it's like, this isn't really a Rescue Rangers movie. Like, this is just, like, reminding you of better things they did. Why? I trust Disney to make their own good stories without having to resort to this.
Right.
So that's that's my thing. So Chris asks, how do you feel to be part of a company that is now 100 years old?
Well, I'm extremely proud to have been a part of Disney. I actually left the company in 2021, so I haven't been there for a couple years, but I spent 26 years at the Disney company and Walt Disney Animation Studios getting to make animation. That's my dream from when I was a little kid. Getting to draw, getting to make animation, getting to direct animation. I mean, I'm very fortunate that I got that opportunity, and I'm so proud of everybody that I got to work with and all the things I got to work on. It's not to be cheesy, but it was a dream come true for sure.
Oh, of course, we have to say, oh, it was a dream come true for me to work at the parks and tour Disney Animation Studios and Pixar and dine at Club 33. Oh, gosh, Club 33 was so fun. If there's any Club 33 members out there, I'm married now. I'd love to take my wife. but you don't work for them anymore. Was that just a layoff, or did you decide it was time to move on to greener pastures?
I decided it was time to look for some new adventures. To try to find some new stories to tell, different parts of myself, just to broaden my horizons. Not that they were narrowed at Disney, but I just wanted to grow. I wanted to explore.
Yeah. Seems like a lot of animators do that. They go and they make their own projects. And hey, look, Glenn finally got an Oscar when he left. Right.
Yeah.
Disney. So there you go. So we'll do one last reader or viewer question. I don't know if I particularly agree with this, but I am curious what a Disney animator thinks of this. He says, I believe Disney secretly hates animation. That is probably the reason why they created the live action remakes so that the films could be viewed as adults. Now, I'm not going to go as far as to say that Disney hates animation, but one of the things that I dislike about the live action movies is that it does seem like Disney's like saying like, oh, here's the live action version that the teens and adults can enjoy, kind of suggesting that the animated movies couldn't be enjoyed by teens and adults. Best picture nomination for Beauty and the Beast.
Right.
Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my thoughts are clouded by the fact that I just hate those live action remakes. Trying to find some clarity on how to respond to that. I don't think they hate animation. I really don't. I understand how you could feel that way. But I think it's purely they're looking. It's not just them. Hollywood, the industry in general, are looking for IPs, intellectual properties that they can cash in on to turn a profit. Mm-hmm. When you can get something that is, again, Marvel, Star Wars, Harry Potter, whatever the, you know, Twilight, whatever the, what some kind of property that is known and that is successful that you can then base a movie on, they will do that. And so this is the same thing. It's taking existing material that is known. People know the Disney animated library, well-known, beloved, instantly recognizable, and they're repackaging it for a new audience. They're doing it with live action, doing it with crazy CG animation and motion capture and whatever they're using. And cashing in on those names. I think it's as simple as that. I don't think they hate animation, but they're seeing it as a source for new material.
Yeah. Okay.
You can hate that or love that. I don't love it, but that's kind of the business right now. Yeah, I mean, so many of the most successful movies, animated movies last year were IPs, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mario. I remember when Mario came out early 2023 and people were comparing it to Strange World the previous year and how well Mario had done. And I'm not trying to take sides with either of those movies, but I just remember thinking, you can't compare those two because Mario is an IP that is what? 40 some odd years old, at least, that people know. I mean, that is a pre-sold idea versus Strange World, which is an original story. That's totally new, totally different. Two totally different movies and two very different creative endeavors. Create something new versus base a movie off of an existing thing. Again, not saying one's better than the other, not saying that it's I'm not making a value judgment on either of those.
Oh, movies. I'll tell you one's better than the other. Strange Worlds was a better movie.
But like there was also Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles last year. It was a hugely successful. A lot of Spider-Verse, it's a Marvel property. Animation's doing the same thing. It's taking a lot of IPs and animating them. So that's just the state of the industry right now, I think.
Right. And also executives always take like the wrong lesson from success. Like, look, we all love Barbie. It deserved to make that money. It deserved those Oscar nominations, but I secretly hated that it was doing so well because I knew what was coming next. And Mattel was like, hey, shared universe, let's make an Uno movie. Let's make a Dino something movie. Let's make a Rock and Sock and Robots. It's like you learned the wrong lesson from this. Like so, yeah, that's a good answer. And in a year where Amazon thinks that their response to getting to be one of the players is to make a Roadhouse remake, a movie that is universally, everyone agrees, like, this is not a good movie. You might enjoy it, but it's not good.
Right.
Like, that's what they, this is just where it is. So anyway, folks, I could talk to this man for a long time if I wanted to, but I told him about an hour. It's been 75 minutes. I think if we actually hit the Meet the Robinsons running length, then it would be too too much. So you're welcome to come back sometime if you want. Maybe when the book is finished. But in the meantime, for all of you who are listening to this, if you are listening to this on a podcast thing and you like interviews like this, let's make it official. Subscribe either on Spotify, Apple. Google doesn't make podcasts anymore because that's just who Google is. But you can find them on us on Deezer and everything. And of course, if you are in an area where you can comment, we'd love to hear your comments on all this. Thank you once more, Stephen. And as a final reminder, go to Indiegogo and look for Disney In Between. Let's get that to 1,000%. Funded. We'll see you next time. Take care, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.